Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture.
Chapter 3 of John Stuart Mill's Utilitarianism has the title of The Ultimate Sanction of the Principle of Utility. And what Mill is talking about in there is something what we would call these days a moral principle or sort of foundation. And he's keen to try to explain this to us, in part because he's trying to address criticisms that have been made against utilitarian philosophy. It's now been a generation in existence by the time that he's writing. He's a second generation utilitarian. And a lot of people have said, and he gives this challenge here, I feel that I'm bound not to rob or murder, betray or deceive, but why am I bound to promote the general happiness, which is the greatest happiness principle or the principle of utility? What is the ultimate ground for this? Why do I have here's a key word, duty to promote the general happiness? Bentham had one set of answers. Mill is going to provide some others, and they have to do in part with his conception of psychology. First, we're going to look at sanctions themselves, his notion of sanctions, which he is deriving in part from the general, culture, but also in part from Bentham. And Bentham had talked about sanctions in his works. He distinguished 4 and then later 5 different kinds of sanctions. Mill talks in terms of external and internal sanctions. What does he mean by external and internal? Internal to the human being. External meaning coming from without in some way. Now, it could involve the feelings of the human being, their pleasure or pain. As a matter of fact, you can't actually have a sanction on somebody unless you are affecting them in some way. And so he talks about the external sanctions, and he says, what are these? They are the hope of favor and fear of displeasure from our fellow creatures, as well as from the ruler of the universe, along with whatever we may have of sympathy or affection for them, or of love and awe for him, inclining us to do his will independently of selfish consequences. What if we take God out of the picture, because Mill is not really all that sincere about God, and that may complicate things. What we're talking about is other people's approval or disapproval, punishment, reward, and then whatever feelings of sympathy or affection which we have for them. So, I help an old woman across the street. That's probably promoting the general happiness, unless that old lady is, would be Hitler or something like that. So, why am I doing that? I could be motivated by my parent telling me, go ahead and help her across the street and I'll make it worth your while. That'd be an external sanction, that's a reward. It could be that I'm worried about what people will think of me if they see me not helping her out, social disapproval. That's also an external sanction. It could be that I actually like her, or I feel sorry for her. I feel some sort of affectivity moving me towards helping her. That also is, in Mill's book, an external sanction. So what would be the sort of things that we could call an internal sanction? People speak in terms of conscience, or closely allied with that, the sense of duty or obligation. And how can you tell when somebody is motivated by internal sanctions rather than external sanctions? Well, when nobody's watching, so you don't have to worry about social disapproval or approval, when there's no punishment or reward at stake, and when they don't have any particular feelings of sympathy or affection already moving them towards that, do they do the right thing? Do they refrain from robbing? Do they return lost property? Do they tell the truth? Do they avoid telling lies or deceiving? We could go down the list. Do they actually do what they should do, what they ought to do? What we're really interested in here is what the internal sanction of duty would be. And he says, it's a feeling in our own mind, a pain more or less intent, attendant upon violation of duty, which improperly cultivated moral nature rises in the more serious cases into shrinking from it as an impossibility. So when somebody says, my conscience won't allow me to do X, Y, Z, they have in mind exactly what Mill is talking about. A highly developed person, this will actually keep them from being even able to consider it as a possibility for themselves, not necessarily as a possibility for other people, but a possibility for themselves. if it hasn't developed that far, it's at least a certain kind of pain in your mind that says, this is wrong, I shouldn't do that. Or when you're being faced with a positive duty, something that you ought to do, that, you know, thinking about not doing it, you feel a sense of pain in that. What is the sanction? What is the basis for utilitarian morality? Mill now is engaging in a bit of psychology, and he says, where do we get these notions of conscience or duty or obligation from? Are they what he calls a transcendental fact, an objective reality belonging to the province of things in themselves, and we just sort of note it? He doesn't actually buy that. He thinks that we have to sort of work this out. So what we want to ask is the notion of duty, as he says, innate? Or is it implanted? Does it arise intuitively from being a human being? Are we sort of born with it? Is it hardwired into us? Or is it something that we acquire through experience, through association, through feeling pleasure and pain, and being directed in certain ways, and then coming to see certain things as good? So you could say a priori or a posteriori if you're into that sort of language. So he says, well, let's take the first one. If it is innate, then he says, I don't see any reason why the feeling which is innate should not be that of regard to the pleasures and pains of others. You know, is there anything really strange about saying that people would intuitively be cognizant and take some consideration of the pleasures and pains of other human beings? Perhaps that's inherent in human nature. Now, you know, you could, of course, say, well, what about sociopaths? What about damaged individuals? And you say, well, that's damaged individuals. In some cases, it would not be innate, but in a normal human being, it would. He says, if there's any principle of morals which is intuitively obligatory, that's a big if. If there's anything that is intuitively obligatory, it would be this principle that we ought not only to pay attention to our own pleasures and pains, but those of other people who are affected by our actions, our choices, and our ways of living. Now, Mill doesn't actually think that it is innate, but he's covering his bets if you know, one does think it is. And he says, if these moral feelings are not innate but acquired, they're not for that reason less natural. It is natural to man to speak, to reason, to build cities, to cultivate the ground. It's also natural to human beings to cultivate themselves, to have rules of right and wrong, to have a sense of obligation, of duty, of conscience developing. So he says, the moral faculty, if not a part of our nature, it's not something we're like born with full-blown, is a growth from it, capable like them, in a certain small degree of springing up spontaneously. So some degree of morality would sort of just come out of our nature. And then the rest of it is susceptible of being brought to, by cultivation, to a high degree of development. That means that our environment and our own sort of self-reflective choices would play a huge role in forming the kind of persons that we are, in determining how strong and what direction this actually takes. So from Mill's perspective, if you get somebody who's completely conscienceless, it could be a product of being in a terrible, terrible environment that gives all sorts of counterproductive messages about these sorts of things. So he's talking about moral associations and whether there's a natural basis of sentiment for utilitarian morality. If it is implanted, where are we going to get this from? It's a good question. So where would we get it from? He says, there is this basis of powerful natural sentiment. Remember, this term natural does not mean just simply born in us, but it's something that we have a capacity for that can be developed. Powerful natural sentiment. And what is that natural sentiment? He says, the desire to be in unity with our fellow creatures, fellow human beings. And so that is going to lead to utilitarian choices and actions. Those, in turn, are going to, there's sort of a cycle here, are going to reinforce this powerful natural sentiment over time through habit, through the force of habit, through the force of association, and produce in us a condition of sort of naturally thinking about how our actions, our choices are going to affect other people in terms of their own pleasures, their own pain, their own happiness, their own misery. He says, the social state is at once so natural, necessary, and habitual to man that except in some unusual circumstances or by an effort of voluntary abstraction, he never conceives of himself otherwise than as a member of a body. And this association is riveted more and more as we are removed from the state of savage independence. So Mill is actually telling a story here where originally we are sort of like the Cyclops in the Odyssey that, you know, which Greek political theorists pick up on. Each man runs his own household, does what he wants, gives himself his own laws, and says, screw everybody else, I'm going to do what I want. Mill thinks that as we become more developed, as we get away from this state of total barbarism or savagery, we begin to take more and more heed of other human beings because we more and more understand, express, fulfill this desire to be in unity with other human beings that makes us feel good. So we do it some more, and eventually it becomes sort of second nature to us. So he says, that's a, sort of the basis. Now, how does this actually take shape? He says, society between human beings, except in the relation of master and slave, so purely tyrannical power relation, except in the relation of master and slave, is impossible on any other footing than that the interests of all are to be consulted. So think of a family, for example. You have a family, and you're not consulting the interests of all. The only way in which you can do that is some person imposes the choice, the power from above on the other people from below, or you just have complete anarchy and everybody does what they're going to do. If you're actually going to have a harmonious family life, the person who's making the decisions in any given case has to consult the interests of everybody else. They have to treat them, not necessarily every single person as equals, but everybody has to treat, as he says, somebody as an equal. He says, society between equals can only exist on the understanding that the interests of all are to be regarded equally. We're supposed to take account of everybody's interests. And he says, in every age, some advance is made towards a state in which it will be impossible to live permanently on other terms with anybody. So we're moving from a state, originally where only power can really take place, to conditions of equality where a sort of limited utilitarian morality becomes the way in which we do things, without necessarily calling it utilitarianism, without necessarily thinking about it in those sort of terms. We begin to consult everybody else's interests, and then as time goes on, we become more and more developed in that respect, and eventually we reach the point where any decision that anybody makes is already thinking about how everybody else is going to be affected. Now, Mill sees that as quite far off. He doesn't think that's going to happen right away. Now, you might say at this point, that doesn't sound like our social life at all. Are you saying, John Stuart Mill, that our experience of social life is that we're all motivated by this intense natural desire to be in unity with our fellow humans? Well, why are people such jerks to each other then? Why are we in competition? And Mill talks quite a bit about, you know, experiences of cooperating with others and what that does. Then he ends up saying that we're at an early stage of development. So a lot of this is kind of far off. He says that, you know, if we really looked at our real interests, not just our imaginary interests, not just what, you know, we're getting from imperfect understandings of the social order or from propaganda or from poor environments that give us bad experiences which we draw the wrong conclusions from. If we can get away from all of that, then we'll see that really we ought to be cooperating with each other. We ought to be thinking about each other. And he ends up saying, this is where I'll actually end this thing. Even if you don't buy this, it would be in your interest, given a society where a lot of people are seeing things in a utilitarian way, to act like a utilitarian, to take on the characteristics of that. And if you do that enough, that habit will become your new character, that will become your new structure of desires. And it's also in your interest to see other people behave that, because think about it. Do you want a purely egoistic environment? No, because you don't want everybody else to be egoist. You don't want them to privilege their pleasures and pains over yours. You want them to take yours into account. And one of the ways to make sure that they're going to do that is by sort of pushing this utilitarian morality on other people. And one way you can do that is by actually, you know, espousing it yourself and acting like a utilitarian. So even if you, he says, even if you don't buy it, even if you have no interest and sympathy in the pleasures and pains of others, you're greatly interested as anyone that others should have it. Mill thinks that all these things come together and provide us with the sense of duty that we have, that ultimately it rests on this sort of complex. And this is the fundamental basis for it, this desire, which comes from our nature, but can be developed further and further to be in unity with fellow humans.
Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.